Guys, this is Succession. This is HBO. If you don't want to hear me talking about Logan Roy, talking about then don't listen to this. There are bad language words in this show. Hello, and welcome to the Snake Linguini episode of Slate Money Succession. We are up to episode 2 of season 3. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Fundrise.
Hello, hello.
And very excitingly, we are here with Kurt Anderson. Welcome back, Kurt.
Couldn't be happier to be back.
Who are you and why, how are you qualified to opine
Anderson
on all of this?
Oh, that's a deep
Kurt
that's
Anderson.
You are the Kurt Anderson.
Anderson.
You know, how am I? I've written novels, some of which are about rich media moguls. I've worked for rich media moguls. I'm old, so I've seen empires come and go.
You are basically the number one most best person we can have on this show. We are going to talk about Jerry's Snake Linguini and all manner of family dysfunction, all coming up on Slate Money Succession.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Kurt, welcome. Great to have you talking about media moguls, which is a subject you know a lot about. Let me just come out and ask you, like, in terms of dysfunctional media families, where would you rate this on a scale of like 1 to verisimilitudinous?
As high as the verisimilitudinous has ever been, and beyond media mogul families. The thing I've been amazed about and impressed by from the beginning of this series is how it gets rich people in general. So, well, forget moguls, forget media people, but rich people. I've never seen it done better, frankly, in television or film. But it does the business really well. And back when I started deciding I wanted to be a novelist and I wrote my first novel, it was a lot of it was set in the world of media moguls and business and stuff. And at that time, it was like, well, this hasn't really been done well in fiction. Let me try to do it well. And it's still rarely done well, but man, this just knocks it out of the park forever. And a friend of mine who was also a big Succession fan said he had seen the trailers and said, oh gosh, there's so much, it's all these round the world shoots and I'm worried it's not going to be as good. Well, based on the first couple of episodes, I certainly have not been disappointed by what I see. You know, and we all know people who are in destructive, dysfunctional families with powerful patriarchs, whether they're media moguls or not, but I feel like these people are convincingly damaged and dysfunctional.
Is this normal for rich families?
Well, I can't speak about all rich families, but I mean, it's not uncommon. I know the ones I know have any firsthand knowledge of, this is kind of a lot the way it is.
So, Kurt, let's talk about this episode, because at the heart of this episode is a glorious scene where we get all four children together in a tiny little room, and it becomes very clear that if they can only coordinate and get their act together and work in concert with each other, then that would be pretty much like the optimal outcome for all of them. And yet their general fucked upness and internal mistrust and dynamics makes that completely impossible.
That's right. You know, it's the prisoner's dilemma kind of thing with four of them instead of two. And I mean, and there's just beyond their fucked upness, there is the general prisoner's dilemma. I just want to do well for myself. Fuck my brothers and sisters or my father or anybody else, which is not unique to rich people or media moguls' children. But yeah, it's beautifully done. And again, beautifully written. I'm not going to stop raving, because especially television writing and film writing, but it's so often rushed to like get to the point, you know, don't spend time meandering around. And in the scenes with the siblings, the Roy siblings, figuring out that, you know, are they going to work together? What's going to go on here? It doesn't obey any kind of screenwriting rules. It meanders in this beautiful, incredibly convincingly naturalistic way. But yes, their weaknesses and their fucked upness is so beautifully apparent. And, you know, and I came away from that and other scenes thinking, like, sort of identifying, in fact, with the father and thinking, like, yeah, I wouldn't give any of these little pipsqueaks control of my company. You know, I don't want any of them to run it, you know, but which was beautifully done.
Which is also what Jerry says, right? When Roman asks for advice, he's like, if we manage to defenestrate Logan, like, which one of us would take over? And she's like, you got to be fucking joking, right? None of you is going to take over.
Well, that, and also, I was just thinking about it. So Jerry, I mean, making Jerry the temporary CEO, of course, is the brilliant move for the dad to do, because it maximizes the chances that the other three are going to stick by his side, because they could still work, you know, they could still win, you know, any of them. So it was, you know, in addition to the fact that they're all, with the possible exception of Shiv, in my view, weak people who you wouldn't want to run your giant multi-gazillion dollar company, just doing this temporary thing of not giving it to any of them is obviously the move to do if you're him.
That was what was clear to me from the episode, that the siblings are all trapped in their sibling dynamic and they're all competing for Logan's love and the role of his successor. And the fact that he keeps them that way, he keeps them dancing for him, they can't overcome it. They would never, ever be able to team up. It's impossible, because Logan has built them that way. That is the dynamic, and they cannot get out of it. And it just becomes clear as these fights continue and they're insulting each other. Shiv says something really terrible to Roman. He walks out of the room, and then they kind of diminish Connor, and he walks out of the room. And then it's still maybe going to go that they're going to team up. And then, of course, the donuts arrive, and the donuts close the deal.
I do think that there's this wonderful little grace note in this episode where Logan, who is definitely at the bottom of his arc right now, he is very weak, he is very desperate, he's reaching out to anyone and everyone he can for any kind of support. And this is very visible to anyone, and it's obviously most visible to Marcia. But he phones up Connor, and in a very kind of transparent and needy way, he's like,
"You're number one, kiddo."
And it's pathetic and it's weak. And Connor knows that it's pathetic and it's weak. But even though he knows it's pathetic and weak, he can't help but like feel validated.
It works. It still works.
It works.
The need for your father's love is so powerful. Even when you see the manipulation happening, you still are so desperate for it, you'll take it anyway.
Well, you'll take just making the effort, the pathetic, unconvincing effort, as something.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that was amazing. You're my number one. Because we all remember, of course, when he hugged Kendall back in season one and he said, "You're my number one boy," right?
Yeah.
Like, no.
No, and the other thing, again, rankings. I mean, as we see so much of these four children in this episode, that they are such distinct characters. I mean, they're so distinct characters, and so, but none of them obvious or familiar stereotypes, you know?
Yeah, they're truly unique and original people, well drawn.
Yeah, and the writing we need to talk about the writing in this episode because, I mean, obviously, Kurt, you brought it up, but this was, I think, Emily, you said something to me a couple of days ago, how this felt like a play, a lot of the writing in this episode. There was a lot of sort of exposition to get through. This wasn't like the most dramatic episode. A lot of it falls on the quality of the writing, and the writing was excellent, but also understated. Like, a lot of the punchlines, the funny things that you come to Succession for, like when Kendall goes to Greg and says,
"You okay, dude?"
"Yeah."
"You wondering if you tied your dick to a runaway train here?"
Or like when Roman says,
"Stretch, it's a fucking scrotum over a timpani drum."
Those are great lines, which if they appeared in something like Veep or In the Loop, would be like boom punchlines, which you'd laugh at. But in this show, you barely notice them. Like, sometimes you need to like watch it a second time to even realize that they're there.
Yeah. Well, it's why I love this show so much, because it is a drama. It is not a comedy. But its creator, Jesse Armstrong, is a guy whose most of whose previous writing career was in television comedy. So it's bringing that sensibility to this dark, serious thing that is not trying to do even the dark comedy of a Veep. It's a serious show in which Roman, because they were brilliant to create him, is the actual joke-telling character. Nobody else tells jokes, really. Again, like much of my favorite literature, film, everything, it is not comic. It is not a comedy, but it has that effect again and again and again. So
I would say it is a comedy.
I know people say that, and when I researched it, I saw that people call it a comedy, but I would think, I mean, it's so not like it's not a half-hour comedy, as we've come to know comedy on TV. It's not, you know, yes, it is. It is comic, but as serious as a heart attack, as they say.
But it's comic in the way that, like, you know, The Death of Stalin, the Iannucci film, was comic, you know?
Yeah, well, except that had, no, that was, I would say, more broadly comic. I mean, there's a character in Roman who tells jokes, and Greg is a funny, God knows, character, and that's what a hard character to play. That kid, that guy does a great job with that very difficult role. But other than, you know, nobody tells jokes, as opposed to The Death of Stalin, which, you know, there were jokes, you know, but it's extraordinary. The other thing about this being like a play and being low key and all that you said, it also doesn't have, as I think practically every previous episode has, any big party or any big event as a sort of set piece. You know, that's one of the things that this show does, and it's always magnificent and everything, but no, it's in a room or in a few rooms, just like stage play.
Yeah, it felt like there were just a few sets. Greg was there for our comedy relief. Greg's pursuit of a lawyer for himself was kind of like the lighthearted bit of the play. And then we returned to the siblings in the room kind of like hashing it out. And it felt like the point of the episode was kind of like to just settle out the alliances. Who is going to be on whose side?
Or to raise the question, because there is like, right now there are no alliances. Right now, everything, all the balls are in the air. And with the exception of, you can be pretty sure, I think at this point, that Jerry is Team Logan. But like beyond that, I can't, and even that one's, you know, there's a small question mark. Like if you think of the six or seven major players, if you include Marcia now, trying to work out who's aligned with whom between the four kids, Marcia, Logan, and Jerry, like, I have no idea.
But I mean, the whole point, so you're not persuaded by the resolution of the meeting in Sophie's room in which the kids like reject Kendall and all claim to be behind Logan. Wouldn't that signal that that's where their alliances are, at least in the short term?
Correct. I am completely unconvinced that any of them is actually aligned with Logan.
Okay. But they're just not aligned with Kendall.
I think it's like what people say about, you know, foreign policy. You have all allies are transactional and temporary. I mean, are any of them motivated in some way by family, human feeling? I don't have that impression.
Well, there is that wonderful line from Connor where he's like, I'm a public figure, and it's not a good look for a public figure to knife his father.
But then he also does say something kind of more like gentle, like, I just can't do that to, you know how he calls him Logan Pop? I just can't do that to Pop or something. You know, it did sort of feel like he didn't want to do that.
Connor did, that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Connor. He, in his doofusy, idiotic way, yes, he could have some human sense of feeling and loyalty for his father. That may have been sincere, or it may have been a thing he said to himself after he decided for whatever other reasons not to join up against Dad to make himself feel like he's a good guy. You know, I don't know.
And I think Kendall also buried himself because he said just a bunch of like batshit crazy things to his siblings and trying to convince him to come over to his side. Like,
good big picture, we're at the end of the long American century. Our company is a declining empire inside a declining empire.
Amen, brother.
People are killing themselves with guns or dope so fast that we're losing pace.
Unsubscribe.
We're fat-fingered fucks and we can only live on cream. U.S. supremacy is waning. What I think is, within that context, we can become omninational and reposition. Because actually we are not tied, culturally or physically, so we are actually in a great position to leapfrog tech. Information is going to be more precious than water in the next 100. Combine all our news operations, become the global news information hub. Amazon is 20 years old, Gates is an old geezer. Detoxify our brand, and we can go supersonic.
This was the best speech. The best speech. Like, I love that Kendall speech so much because it's like he comes out and he's like, guys, can we clean slate this? And then he just launches into this absolute tidal wave of jargon and bullshit. And somehow, in his, you know, deep in his rubber, plastic Jesus rubber soul, like, feels that somehow this is going to persuade his siblings to come along with him. And you're like, this has everyone, like, rolling their eyes, and he's talking about, like, it's the end of a long American century and leapfrog tech and epiphenomenon and blah, blah, blah. And everyone watching that speech and all of the siblings are like, oh my God, you're such a nerd. And yet Kendall doesn't have the human ability to understand that this is exactly the wrong thing to say at this time.
To these people, especially. And what, you know, the thing is, again, brilliant, because they all are basically are rolling their eyes and like not buying it, but it's not stupid. As a way to pitch that rap about the end of America and all the whole thing, it wasn't a comically dumb thing. It just, as you say, he didn't understand that it wouldn't sell. And the other thing, you know, having been the guy who has the drug problem, the kind of cokehead manic quality of Kendall's whole character in this episode is so, we don't see him doing drugs, I don't think, but man, if that isn't a cokehead, I don't know if I've ever seen one.
But yeah, and he definitely has a mad attack of the logorrhea, and he loves like, he turns to Shiv and he goes, is it cowardice or avarice? And you're like, ooh, those are good words.
Yes, exactly.
Is that, for you rich dude experts out there, like, is this like something that's maybe typical of someone born into massive wealth who's never been told no and who maybe thinks they're a little bit of a genius, feels like he can say and do things like this because everyone treats him with unearned respect? So then
it does have a little bit of Jared Kushner to it, right?
Yeah, that's what I think. That was my takeaway. Like, this rich guy does not know how to run a business. He doesn't know how to talk about strategy. He's like low-grade idiot unqualified, and now that's clear. And I did feel like Shiv was persuaded not to get onto his side by how dumb he sounds, because she sounded smart in her strategy in the past.
It's funny, I hadn't thought of the Jared connection, but yes, he's very Kushnerian, Jared Kushnerian, except, of course, you know, Jared, at least so far, and obviously it's too late now, never did the thing that, you know, he coulda, shoulda done about his father-in-law. He shoulda pulled the Kendall, right, and never did. But in his, like, in over his head, kind of entitled but insecure, skinny way, Kendall is a very Jared guy.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the things that really struck me about this episode is the way that everyone lies to everyone about everything. For no particular reason. Like when Kendall goes off to talk to Stewie and, you know, over the street, he's like, I'm going to go hug my kids. When Shiv asked Tom if he knew that she was at Kendall's house, he's like, no, I didn't know. Like, all of these pointless lies, right? There's no reason for these lies, but they just lie reflexively because, what did Jerry call it? A snake linguine.
Well, if you're playing a game all the time, you're playing liar's poker all the time, you're going to lie. Because no particular reason except keep your cards close to your vest because you're playing this card game, you know? So, but to that point, I mean, only time I was ever like a boss of a lot of people, one of the reasons I decided like, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore much, because it seems to me when you're running any kind of business, even one, you know, a magazine with 100 people who work there, you gotta lie. You are required to dissemble at least, if not lie. And so if you're in this, if you're running whatever it's called, Waystar Royco.
Yeah.
Part of doing that at any level is not instinctively and by default telling the truth. So, you know, it goes with that, even if you're not lying to your siblings and father about your other siblings and your father.
I think lying and controlling access to information is a way to feel powerful when you maybe aren't or can't feel powerful, or you're trying very hard.
Oh,
to be
definitely.
Powerful.
Like that wonderful scene with the manila envelope where Kendall writes fuck you and puts it in the envelope and hands it and puts it in the place where Shiv is going to look. I mean, it's this wonderful sort of way of trying to feel powerful, but also just such a sibling move. Like, we have all done that to our siblings, right?
The other thing that you get that this show does well, just in everything about how it's made and shot and everything else, is the bubble in which they exist of just, you know, being among themselves and their minions and their and is fantastic. And because again, that's been my experience as an anthropologist of the super rich and of big time executives in general, is the bubbles in which they live, you know, and being shocked at like what a cup of coffee costs at Starbucks, which a mogul of my acquaintance once did in my presence. And I think they just do that so well. And not that it's so, you know, I mean, yeah, they have private jets and all that, but this show does not do the dynasty, you know, Dallas, I'm dating myself, kind of wealth porn quite as much as it could. I don't know, except for private jets, to me, their life is not very enviable, you know?
Yeah,
nothing except private jets.
They don't do that. Nothing is shot in a way that's like, dating myself too, lifestyles of the rich and famous-y, or like makes you covet anything these people have. And in fact, I feel like what they've done with Logan so far in these first two episodes is like, he is kind of trapped in the most down market. We talked about this last week, the most like down market 5-star hotel that's ever been. And there's this one shot in episode 2 that they hone in on Logan's salad, and it's like one of those sad hotel salads with the cubes of ham and the cubes of cheese, and he's just like poking at it, and I was like, billionaire or not, like that's a bad salad.
Yeah, I'm with you. The salads are universal.
I had that same so salad moment. I go, wait, you know, no, I want to be in my hotel room and have this glorious Cobb yes. salad that, of the likes of which I've never seen. No, that exactly.
Ugh, and he just looks, and that's when he's at most like, he says, the world is wobbling. I need Shiv. I need, you know, I need Connor. I need all my people.
But who he needs and who he says he needs and who he gets is, and I cannot overstate how happy I am about her reemergence into the show is Marsha. Like, she was missing for most of season two. And boy, is she back. And I mean, she has found him at his moment of maximum weakness. It has come in with maximum leverage. She is being incredibly nice to him and, you know, is extracting God knows how many billions of dollars in the process in this incredibly mercenary way. And oh my God, Marsha.
Oh my God, Marsha. She swoops in and they have this, like, it's the moment where I guess Logan's supposed to apologize to her, but he's obviously incapable of doing that and says, like, I can't eat shit, Marsha. I just can't. And the closest he gets to apology is saying, I can sometimes get distracted. And that literally counts as the apology. And then all that has to happen next, Marsha says, of course, I might like to have a small conversation with somebody. Which is code for, like, I need a lot of money to make this happen. Make it happen for me. And it does. It was so amazing.
She has the single best line in the episode. I have to come out and say, this is the best line of the episode. It's when, like, Hugo says to her, like, look, nothing happened.
Because we really would say that nothing ever happened.
She's a whore, and it's not my problem if she wouldn't finish him.
Yes. Interesting thing about her, too, is one of the things that I thought, again, was so plausible and realistic about this whole thing is that none of them really have any fixed plans, which is to say Logan or the kids or what are we going to do now or Kendall. Like, they're just like, they're at sea. She is the one character who comes in, here's exactly what I want, bye, and here's my person that will get it for me, and I'll go massage Logan's neck in the background while she does the deal. No, she is like, wow, talk about like captain of industry, you know, master of the universe. She's it in this episode.
Someone sent an email about like some prediction market where they're taking bets on who's going to be the CEO of Waystar Royco, and she's up there. I think she might have had the best odds, Marsha. And I kind of, after what Kurt's saying is totally true. She's the one with the strategy. She executes her plan. She gets what she wants. Like, I cannot say the same for anyone else. So maybe she has the chops. Maybe she's the one.
I do want to talk a little bit, unpack this wonderful Greg Lawyer subplot. Greg is not the smartest egg, but he's smart enough to know that he needs a lawyer. And so he turns to his like school friend and is like, what should I do? And she's like, I have no idea. I'm in my first semester. And basically he has Kendall saying, I will set you up with a lawyer who is obviously going to be aligned with Kendall. He has Jerry literally sending a lawyer to his door and saying like, here's your lawyer who's obviously going to be aligned with Waystar. And he feels like he can't choose. Like, does he want the Waystar lawyer or does he want Kendall's lawyer? And what he winds up doing is meeting his grandfather. And the grandfather says, I'll set you up with a lawyer. And Greg, once it's already too late, realizes that even Ewan, the avuncular grandfather, like, is just out for his own agenda and has no interest in giving Greg actually what Greg needs. And that is the first case where Ewan feels a little bit despicable, I think, in this show.
If not despicable, certainly his moral high ground got lower. And again, what an interesting choice to make him not just be a guy who disapproves of his brother for whatever reason, but actually has this specifically left-wing agenda with his old, you know, William Kunstler-esque left-wing lawyer. What an interesting choice. I mean, Greg, to me, he's plausible and hilarious. And he's why I think that's such a hard character to play is he is the most truly, almost implausibly comic character in his stupidity. Not entirely, because we all know stupid young dude bros like that, but or maybe we do. But I think it, if they don't have it pasted on the wall of their writer's room, but some version of nobody is good in this show. No character is totally virtuous in this character.
Or even partially virtuous, really. I mean,
well, Ewan is maybe partially virtuous, and Greg is you know, for all that Greg has done, is not the is you know, maybe the least evil, you know.
I don't understand like what the end game there actually is. Does that mean they want to take down Waystar Royko? Like what is happening with that? I don't know.
We'll see. I mean, that's why it's so interesting.
So like, but Ewan has been like dropping the same hint twice. He's like, I'm putting my affairs in order. And Ewan is a major shareholder of Waystar Royko. And what it means for him to be putting his affairs in order, you know, it would not surprise me if he were somehow back-channeling with Sandy and Stewie. But also, like, he probably hates Sandy and Stewie just as much as he hates his own brother. So, you know, there could, who knows, maybe there's some like weird connection between Ewan and Marsha. Like, again, like the alliances is fluid, but he, I think, has a plan. Marsha has a plan, but I think Ewan has a plan as well. We just don't know what that plan is.
Speaking of the left, this the sudden left wing story thread, I thought they did, again, what don't they do well, but the calls that Logan and Jerry made to the president and the president's whomever, chief of staff or whoever that was supposed to be, were so well done and shows, you know, the actual access of super rich people, especially super rich media moguls, to presidents and their, you know, closest minions. And again, as a, just a glimpse of plutocracy, you know, really just lovely without being overdone and not like, you know, calling up, you know, and Logan saying to the president, do this, and the president does it. Nothing that broad or crude or vulgar, you know, just the way it would actually, I think, be and come down and play out.
Is that how it would be? I mean, I was thinking, I guess, of Roger Ailes and Donald Trump and that whole time, you know, period where Trump would come out and say like nice things about.
Yeah, but Trump, I mean, Trump, we can't assume that the president in this, that the what is he called? The Raisin?
The Raisin.
Is Donald Trump or anybody like him. But yeah, I don't know whether it's how it would play out. It's just, it's more subtle and nuanced and less like, you know, stupid than it would be so often done in fiction.
And I think that, you know, it, the relationship that Logan has with the president is probably not that far off the relationship that, say, Rupert Murdoch had with George W. Bush. It's less powerful. Like, Rupert Murdoch has much more access to and even control over the heads of state in the UK and Australia. But it's, but like, so he's still in a little bit of sort of supplicant mode when it comes to the president of the United States, but he definitely has access.
Exactly. And again, Trump is this outlier so far, where, you know, I'm sure Rupert Murdoch could call him up and tell him that I'm sure there was a more direct thing there than ever existed with Rupert Murdoch and the previous presidents or subsequent presidents.
Right. With Trump, of course, famously, he would call Rupert and would just rant at him on the phone to the point at which Rupert kept on trying to like hang up on him and Trump would just not shut up.
Yeah. So the thing of being, oh, the president's not going to talk to you, so your number two talk to the president's number two. Yeah, that seemed true.
And I was going to say, in terms of plutocracy, there's a scene in season two where Logan says something about the Raisin, the president. He says something like, I've seen so many of these guys. Like, I've been in business, I've seen, what, 8, 10 presidents? Like, he believes himself to be, and I think probably is true for a lot of these guys, to be more powerful than a president. He's in and out. Like, Logan is, was the forever president, right? I mean, these guys have more power than any political figure.
Some do. Like, and I think that's one of the differences between media moguls and the ultra rich. That, like, media moguls have wealth and power, whereas rich people just have wealth.
Depending on how corrupt the party is we're talking about.
But we can go back to the limo, Felix, with Sandy's daughter and Stewie. Thank God Stewie is back. I felt about his reappearance. I wanted more. I missed him in the first episode.
Everyone loves
tried to send a severed head, but the paperwork was too much. It was great. I was really glad to see him. I hope he plays. He gets almost all the good lines. Him and Roman, I think, vie for the best lines, right? So, but it wasn't clear to me, back to the limo conversation, is Sandy and Stewie, are they back with Kendall now? Are they?
So Sandy and Stewie are still in this, the longest proxy fight that has ever existed in the history of proxy fights. It started in season one, and it's still going on in, like, episode two of season three. And basically, Kendall is making a proffer to them. He's saying, if we team up, if I put my votes with you, I will give you the board seats. I will make you a central part of the board, and you can have a bunch of control and power, and we will kick out Logan. And in return for that, can you, like, drop this proxy fight? And Sandy and Stewie kind of, at this point, are not persuaded that Kendall has a clue what he's doing. And so they're basically being non-committal. But one little bit of reality that I did want to ask you specifically about, Kurt, was when Connor talks about the wolf pack, when he talks about the guys that, you know, with Logan and Mo and the Wolfpack and the guys who are, like, running the cruises and running the show. And there have been a lot of profiles of late of David Zaslav, who is the new media mogul in town, and how he does these big, you know, all-male retreats and dinners with all of the other media moguls. And it feels, I think the word Wolfpack might actually have, like, been in some of those profiles. Does the Wolfpack as a concept still exist in media?
That's a very good question. It seems like, you know, certainly since 2017, the stakes and the risks of wolfpackery would have made it more rare. But you do have the shadow of the late unlamented Jeffrey Epstein, of course, and that was all happening, you know, a decade within, you know, not the last couple of years in that way, but certainly recently. Still, I mean, sure. I mean, is there stuff like that going on? I would, you know, the wise bet would be to bet yes. And there is a sense in terms of the show, which is it's in the past, right? They talk about it as these older guys in the past. So that seems entirely plausible. And again, in the previous season, they explained what that was all about more specifically. And now in this episode, in this season, they're just kind of referring to it as though we know, because we do. But again, it's interesting, given that is the big part of Kendall's turn play, is that how relatively unspecific in what we just have seen they are being about what those crimes and misdemeanors are.
The pipeline of sad dancers.
Yes,
Shift does, like, provide a little bit of useful aid in memoirs when she's talking about, like, throwing migrants off the side of boats and in international waters and that kind of, you know, less than sterling behavior.
And in terms of hiring these female comms and people and lawyers, if you're Kendall, it obviously makes that all the more interesting. Yeah. I mean,
all of the powerful lawyers are women, right? It's just the slightly doofusy communist who's a man.
Correct. And so far, I mean, none of those people, even though they're on the right side because Kendall is on the right side, come across as sterling epitomes of virtue either.
No, and Kendall explodes at Shiv at the end of that whole conversation and makes that crass comment about her.
I was the only one you wanted, yeah? I was the only one who mattered.
Yeah, only because you're the girl. Girls count double now, didn't you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I know. I fucking know.
It's only your teats that give you any value. So, you know, it's only your teats.
He makes that comment and just undercuts everything he's said before. You know, he's on the right side of everything. And then he says, the only reason I wanted you is because you're a woman and you're more valuable in these times. It's like, okay, well, it's clear now, though we knew before, that this is not about ethics.
No. And now women are worth twice. Women are worth double. No, that was brilliantly done, and leaves it up to you, the viewer, to sort of say, oh, this is just bullshit. He's, you know, this being the, you know, fighter for women, without having any character say that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the beautiful too, I think, like you're saying, that they don't really like spell out the allegations ever, even when they first broke in season two. We still don't have like a fully clear understanding of what happened actually. Like, it's just sort of like out there. There's like hints of it, but it's not you're not being banged over the head with it.
There was that very long Wall Street Journal story, but like the characters have read it, but we just kind of got
Yeah, we don't know what it says. This season, like, it could be like a quote unquote, like, about the Me Too, how Me Too played out in the media and amongst powerful people. And the truth about how it played out is so different from how you would maybe think about it from the outside. You know, it's just about bad times for powerful people and how they react to it and align themselves around it. It has nothing to do with like, we're exposing bad behavior, blah, blah, blah. Also, I just very randomly need to mention this. The photo for Logan on Shiv's phone is Saddam Hussein. I just needed to mention that in case you missed it. Go back.
That was so great.
Missed it.
Wow. That was the very first shot in the episode is that, yeah, Logan's phoning and like up comes Saddam Hussein is the picture. And you're like, that is awesome.
Have we had any, speaking of which, in this show so far, any jokes about any of them calling themselves Uday and Kusei or something? And I guess not. But
no, I mean, we did have Roman kind of kidnapped in some obscure Middle Eastern country.
Oh, right. Yeah. That was fun.
Or Turkey, one of those. I don't know if it was obscure Middle East. Or, yeah.
But as a great Murdochologist, Kurt, we should also...
I'm not Michael Wolff. Who do you think you're talking to?
Really? I thought you were Michael Wolff. I should ask you about the bit where Marcia starts laying out her list of demands, and she's like, I want to be part of the trust. I want my children to be like part of the trust. Like, this is very, very much a Murdoch thing, right? This is exactly what Wendy Deng did with her daughters.
Precisely correct. And why I brought her up earlier is, yes, it is exactly. Even though in that instance, in the real life quasi inspiration for this story, I think she did that actually before the end of the marriage, and this isn't the end of the marriage. And he had some leverage in that case because of her shenanigans with, say, the
Tony
Blair, minister of the UK. Yes.
All right. So, Emily.
Yes.
What did you think of this episode overall? Do you have a favorite line? Do you have any major takeaways?
I feel like this is kind of like a setup episode, you know? It's setting us up for the rest of the season, but in itself, it's not, I don't think it's one of my favorite episodes. So, and as far as favorite lines, because that's what we always do on Slate Money Succession, I think it would be...
Oh, you mean us? This multi fucking ethnic transgender alliance of 20-something dreamers we got right here?
Which is what Roman said to refer to he
Such
and his
a great
siblings.
Line. Such a great line. I think I'm going to go with a Roman line as well, which is when he calls up Jerry and he goes, "I'm just going to put my dick in your mad scheming scissor hands here." I agree. I think this was, there was a bunch of like blocking and tackling in this episode, which is setting us up for future fireworks. But Kurt,
I think there was you had to do what they did, or you had to do. You had to do the, okay, now what happens? And the fact that they did it without any, you know, 6 months later, but it was like moments after the previous season ended, I think I liked, because it didn't seem a cheat. It seemed more real. So I thought that was fine. It wasn't, if we had to rate all whatever, how many episodes there have been, 20X so far, it's not one of the very best. But given that I'm always worried with shows I love, like, oh, is it going to keep it up? Ooh, is it going to be as good? I felt like, whoa, we're back. I am satisfied, even though it's not one of the best episodes ever.
Like, I'm sure we're all watching it on HBO Max. It's on demand. I can say, as someone who's watched it twice, it's better the second time. If you can, you know, if you're the kind of person who likes to ever watch episodes twice, Succession is definitely one of the shows where you do want to watch it twice, and especially this episode, benefits from a second.
Well, and now I need to watch it twice just to see Saddam Hussein come up on.
Wait, you only need to watch it for the first like 30 seconds, and then you can turn it up.
But no, so I'm not worried at all, and I think all that was great in general about the previous seasons to me is I feel like they've still got their stuff. They're not being complacent. They're not being lazy.
Oh, wait, I just need to mention one more line because I love it so much and I forgot. Because Greg doesn't have so many awesome lines, but that line where he turns to Kendall and goes,
you know, I don't really want to go to Congress again. I'm kind of too young to be in Congress so much, you know?
So once again, applause for the writer's room, Succession. We love them very much, based as they are in my hometown of South London. Thank you, Kurt, for coming on the show. It's always amazing and awesome and brilliant to have you on the show.
Well, you know, you keep giving away perks like advanced screening copies of Succession, and I'll be back as often as you want.
Brilliant. So yeah, we will be back next week with episode 3 of Slate Money Succession.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.